This is a CNA podcast.
The tragedy unfolded last month at River Valley High School. A young life was taken. A 16-year-old was arrested for murder. As Singapore grappled to make sense of it, Education Minister Chan Chun Sing spoke frankly about the big challenges facing young students in Parliament last week.
We know our young people face pressures on many fronts.
He also set forth a plan of action on what must change.
We want to work with parents and community groups to establish a caring and enabling society that gives greater attention to the well-being of our young.
Since the incident, the mental health of Singapore youth has become the focus of our collective fears. But why didn't we see it coming? How deep-seated are such mental health challenges? And if so, do the suggested solutions go far enough? Or are they simply a band-aid when deeper systemic and mindset shifts are needed? It's Thursday, 5th of August. Welcome to Heart of the Matter with me, Lin Su Ling. Now, calling in to talk to us about these issues and more are Minister of State for Education, Sun Xueling.
Hi, everyone. This is Xueling.
Adrian Tan, parent of four, his oldest sitting for the PSLE this year.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
And Bettina Yap, principal counselor at Care Corner.
Hi, everyone.
Now, Xueling, maybe we start with you. Really kudos to MOE for tackling rising stress levels over the years. I recall since 2012, there's been, you know, the ridding of school rankings, top scorers, changing the PSLE scoring system and even fewer tests. So the question is, I know hindsight is 2020, but does the River Valley High School incident suggest MOE could have moved more aggressively and earlier to relieve the competitive pressures of the education system? What's your take?
I think the stresses that a young person faces is actually quite multifactorial. Academic stress is definitely one component, but there are also stresses arising from, let's say, relationship tensions that they may have with their family or their friends or other uncertainties that they're facing in their lives. This is from what we gather from young people they have spoken to.
Okay, but let's stay on the academics first before we branch out into the areas of stress. So Bettina, jump in here. We know that our kids are among the top PISA scorers in the world. They dominate math, science, and Olympiad competitions. We know they're smart and strong. So how are they also brittle?
There are various facets of smart in a sense. So we can be academically strong, but at the same time, just due to experiences or upbringing or exposure, maybe because sometimes for some, life has been good. So when they fail at school, it becomes such a big thing because it feels like this is the all important. There is that resilience building that comes from just having failed and kind of gotten up again and to try again. So I think with a lot of my clients, I have some who are very high functioning. They're not used to that. They're not used to failing. They're not used to being not the first. So that actually creates a different sort of stress as well. So emotionally, sometimes they struggle. You're in the teens, you're in that stage of identity formation, social pressures, social media pressures. They really do have to kind of handle different facets of life in that sense.
But are you saying that our national academic success has been the blind spot obscuring our vision of the downsides of this success?
We talk about balance. So I think that life is not only just about academics. You know, I think students nowadays are amazing. They do well in school. They've got all these CCAs. They're actually quite well-rounded. But I do think that is shifting, you know, where we're trying to shift some of the focus away. You are not your grades. There are other things important in life to pursue. So I feel like we are trying to move towards that. But cultural change takes a while as well. It's hard to change. Like, I think we can shift over time, but the academic aspect has always been an important part of achievement and identity in Singapore. So we can't run away from that. But I do think we are trying to kind of make progress in other aspects to encourage different talent developments, to recognize that just because you cannot make it academically, that's not the end of the road in that sense.
I just want to pick at whether you think we could have seen this coming. Like you mentioned, there are efforts underway to try to get rid of stress and try to focus on other broader aspects of success. And we also know that the calls to SOS have been inching up. IMH themselves have said that more people are seeking help for school stress. We knew this all as far back as 2018 or so. Why didn't we see the signs of this stress? Did we drop the ball?
I wanted to add that we have been updating our character and citizenship education syllabus. I'm mentioning it because obviously I think adults, educators, we are concerned about the stresses that young people face, and we want to make this a part of our conversation, both at home and in schools. So in schools, we updated the CCE curriculum to specifically talk about mental well-being, especially for this year. We wrote that out across all schools from primary school onwards. And the way the lessons are conducted in class is really to facilitate an exchange, to encourage students to open up, to talk so that teachers can listen, counselors can listen, and also to share with young people that there are help channels available if they would like to reach out for help. You had mentioned that there are several helplines, hotlines that are available. You mentioned SOS. The MOE also works with them. We look at what they're doing. We also pay attention to the number of calls that they're receiving. We also launched a national care hotline last year because of COVID-19. So these are steps that the government is actively taking, but it is something that we have to partner the whole of society about. Parents, community stakeholders. I mean, we have online with us Adrian, who's a parent of four, and also Bettina, who is a counselor at Care Corner. These are partners that we really appreciate, you know, because we know that this is something we need to do together for the good of our young people.
Sherling, how do you reconcile that? Because as you pointed out, there are partners involved in this, parents, whole of community, there's a lot of spotlight on this, a lot of focus at MOE itself. So how do you reconcile this mushrooming of initiatives on the one hand, but also on the other hand, that incident at River Valley occurring, and also Minister Chan Chun Sing emphasizing mental health very specifically at Parliament?
All of us here in this studio, we are all fellow Singaporeans. And I thought it was quite interesting just now when Bettina mentioned that academic qualifications has been very much a part of our Singapore landscape. It has been for quite a while. But there are obviously new challenges that young people face. Bettina also talked about social media. There are new challenges that we face. And the fact that there is these, I would call it mushrooming of helplines and resources, show that we want to try to actively solve the problem. I don't think we can necessarily solve it once and for all, because if you think about it, right, stress, wanting to do well, trying to build an identity for yourself is really actually part of the human condition. The question is, how do you react to these stresses? I think that's the question that all of us were trying to put our heads together to crack.
Let's try to pull in Adrian here. Adrian, there was a study by the OECD in 2019 that got a lot of attention in Singapore that said Singapore kids are most fearful of failure when you look at cross-developed economies. Do you think that's simplifying issues as a parent? Do you see that in your oldest as he prepares to take the PSLE?
Firstly, I think my oldest is one of the exceptions because he has failed so much. So the only way for him is up. So it's very easy for him. But having said that, I do see and monitor some of the situation that his classmates will be going through, as well as some of the things that they are required to undertake. And I often say to myself, if I were 13-year-old right now to go through what they're going through, I think I would have broken down.
Oh, no.
So kudos to them to have the resilience.
Wait, what are they going through that is different?
From what I can remember of my 13-year-old, after school, go and play. That's it. There's no tuition, no enrichment, no CCA, no after-school project, nothing at all. But for them right now, and I think to a large extent also my fault because of peer pressure, when I have him much younger, I tell myself, oh, I'm going to be one of those cool parents. I'm not going to put him through this and that. But eventually when peer pressure comes, you will just succumb to it.
How do you succumb to it?
Well, when other parents will be like, oh, you know what my kids got? And you know, the things that they said in the movie, I'm not stupid. Those are entirely real. Those are not made up. Those are real situation. And as a parent, you also want to make sure that he doesn't lose out to where his peers would be, which is slightly ahead or even far ahead than him. So you try to help him to make up for it, for what he may not be able to understand clearly in school. You try to make it up at enrichment. You try to make it up at boot camp, etc. And of course, all this takes time. And when all the time are being devoted to academic, there's no time for anything else. Even wind down time, you barely have any time for that.
I guess it's not so clear cut. A child wouldn't enjoy doing questions, worksheets, homework, but these have to be done.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think those are things that, unfortunately, I guess to a large extent, as much as we are trying to move away from having PSLE as a high-stake kind of thing, the vast impression is still pretty high-stake. You still want them to get into a good school and try to be much more efficient in their studies. And this is the things that if parents can, of course, try to make up for it, they'll try to make up for it.
Bettina, it sounds like stress is a normal part of our lives. There maybe have been an uptick in the last couple of decades, but where some level of stress is good indeed to spur us to achieve our best and reach higher, what are some signs that students, parents, and teachers should look out for when stress becomes toxic? Is there a tipping point?
If it's that obvious already, that might be a bit late, okay, but better late than never, you know. Each child is different. So hopefully there's enough interaction to realize, hey, my child is maybe talking less or maybe talking more than usual, you know, or maybe they're becoming more withdrawn. We always look at like appetite and sleep and motivation. So these are actually aspects that we are kind of checking in on. Unless you're a parent who has a good relationship with your child and your child tells you a lot of things, then that's easier to track. The challenge is that with a lot of the young people who come to me, they are like, I don't really talk to my parents about these things. And they are at that age, right, where it's really about the peers more than the parents. They're trying to individuate, trying to find their own identity. Sometimes the generation gap sort of adds to that. So with a lot of my young people, even though we are engaging them for mental health help, it's either they don't want their parents to know, or they feel like I don't want to burden them, or they feel like they won't understand, or I told my mom or my dad, and they are like, oh, just talk to me lah. Why you need to go and talk to a mental health professional? So I think that they kind of stuck in that kind of place. And for parents, right, to hear that, oh, you know, my child might have a mental health issue, it's also kind of a shock. And then there's the denial, and then there's the guilt that comes with that. Actually, there are a lot of emotions in there that sometimes make it hard to kind of really communicate sort of accurately or be able to meet each other and support each other. So, I mean, a lot of my work is at kind of like around that sometimes, you know, having to mediate or support the parent and support the child or bring them together to be able to have a conversation.
Can I share something from personal experience?
You know, I was just about to ask you that, if you don't mind. I wanted to ask you, actually, so much of this is about lived experiences. And Shreling, you had this Facebook post recently about the stress that you yourself face, picking a JC, the sheer drudgery of it. You talked about how it informs how you will parent your own children. Could you start by telling us what moved you to post that? Because people did say they commended your honesty and bravery in talking about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was reading these news reports, you know, at the MOE. I also have the chance to interact with many students. And just now when I was listening to Bettina, you know, what she said about losing sleep, losing weight, it's all very, very real. I remember when I was at that age, right, as a teenager, it's strange, you know, when you're depressed, you can sleep a lot, but it's never enough. You feel tired every time you wake up. And you just realize that, wow, it's another day you have to go through. And you just felt that there was a lack of meaning, you know. And I think for a young person, what you actually want at that point in time is for someone to listen to you and not to judge. And I think Bettina mentioned an important point about how parents react to it. Because I think when a young person faces challenges, and if you have a close relationship with your parents, the immediate first thing you would want to do is to go to your parents because they've been there for you since young. But if the relationship isn't a strong one, if the relationship isn't a warm one, then you may feel that you have no one to go to. You may want to seek out friends. And nowadays, you might be trying to go on social media because it looks like on social media, you have many friends. But they may or may not give you the best advice. It's hard to tell.
But Shreling, during your time, there was probably no social media. Did you talk to your parents then to tell them how you felt?
There was no social media then, but actually two things are similar. One is that feeling of loneliness that a person who is depressed feels. You can be lonely physically, you can be lonely on social media. That sense of loneliness when a young person doesn't feel like you fit in or you haven't quite, like what I think Bettina used the word, you know, individuate, you know, and find identity for yourself. When you haven't found those, you feel lost. And that's the same whether or not there is social media or not. And like what I mentioned, different people may approach different channels. I would like to think that parents are the first shoulder that you cry on, but it may not be the case for everyone. It's different.
So how did you get through it? How did you go through that period? Was it just something that changed? Was it gradually over time?
Different people have different personalities. Some people are more open and they may want to talk to others. There are others who are very quiet and silent. I think I belong more to the latter category.
The silent one.
Yeah, the silent ones. We look perfectly okay from the outside, you know. And we all find our individual ways. So I read, listen to music. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. But on hindsight now, as an adult, right, and being an MOE myself, and also, you know, I think what Minister Chan said in his ministerial statement about comparing other people, and also finding a way to derive confidence for yourself, to be able to find a certain spot, a certain oasis of calm for yourself amidst this hustle and bustle that's happening around you, amidst all this comparison, amidst all this academic stress, amidst all this noise that's around you. You know, I think if we can help the young person who is vulnerable find an oasis of calm within all this and to feel confident in his or her abilities and to have the grit, you know, to overcome this very difficult time of their lives, then I think we're off to something new and that we can have something to look forward to.
Just want to draw on your experience again. I don't know if this is hard to talk about, but I think people do find encouragement in hearing from someone who's been through a similar situation. What helped you get through that period? What helped you say one more day, okay, get through it? Was there something that you thought made some difference?
I mentioned that I read. Sometimes you'll be amazed, you know. You can come across a quote, a picture of a lighthouse, for instance. We can look up at the color of the sky. It's different for different people. You know, you can have different, how should I put it, sparks, you know, or flashes or imagery, you know, and it's different for different people. And that's why I think it's very important that as a community, we try to create as many of these positive imageries, words, dialogues, or you never know what a vulnerable person may see that day. You'll be surprised. I've heard stories. It is the same for me. You will come across something like a poster on the wall. And that thing that you saw on that wall that day gave you that confidence to live one more day. It sounds very weird, but it's absolutely true. And that's why I think that it is so important for all of us as a society to try our very best to create those messages of hope for young people. And you never know. A young person may watch that video, that poster you created, that word you wrote, and that might be the source of strength to get that young person through to the next day.
Were you really thinking of ending it all, in your words, finally getting some rest?
I don't want to put ideas in people's minds. And, you know, I'm very, very worried about all these copycat episodes. But I was very, very tired. I was very, very tired.
But the Sun Xueling in front of us wouldn't be the same person had she not gone through those hardships?
I think so. I think when you've been through difficult times and there are different forms of difficult times in people's lives, this sounds so stuck, you know. But what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I think.
I actually resonate with that because I remember when I went into university and I was like really struggling. I am in this new place without any of my friends. I remember I was probably crying for like quite a few months, but I also remember then that coming up from that, as I look back, I wouldn't have traded that for anything because it sort of helped me kind of get a deeper sense of who I am as a person. It kind of gave me sort of like a good foundation kind of to build who I am on.
But only in retrospect.
Yes, I think so. I think it's hard. Like you cognitively know, it's like, okay, you know, I can survive this. But it doesn't mean that I'm just like, oh, yes, bring it on. I mean, I think that's a reality. You know, with a lot of my clients, they go through this. They're just like, oh my goodness, am I ever going to get through this? And because I've journeyed with them for a while, I'm like, you have been here before, right? You know, and they're like, oh yeah, that's true. And how do you get out and you survive, right? And you came out of it and you're like, oh yeah. And sometimes we forget we're in that kind of valley. We just like, it's so dark. That's all you can see. We can't remember the good times, you can't remember how we survive or cope. But with a lot of my clients, that's exactly what they did. And sometimes, like Shannon was talking about, yeah, you never know kind of what you say. And sometimes it's even just being that one safe person that that person can turn to. Just knowing, you know, you're not going to advise me, tell me anything that's not really helpful in your well-meaning ways, but just to be there for me, just listen to me, just understand. I think that is great. It's really like so precious to be able to talk to someone and feel like they understood, they see me in all my brokenness and weakness. And we are all broken and weak in some way or another. I think part of the pressure comes from just trying to have to look like, oh, we're okay, we're all put together and everybody's sort of faking it. You're like, fake it till you make it kind. Yeah, if we could just be more open about vulnerability and that we struggle. And I really appreciate what Shannon shared about that. We just need to recognize that this is life. We all struggle, but there is still resilience. There is that shaping that comes from that. If we can just kind of like, just one step at a day, like one step at a time, you know, like sometimes my clients, that's just it. Okay, I'm just like, just one day at a time, one step at a time. And slowly we come out of that. But it's really hard. In the meantime, nobody says like, bring it on, give it to me, right? Nobody wants to suffer and struggle. And we're not a culture that embraces tears and sadness.
But what if we are? What if we can be? And I ask this because
I would love that.
Is there
actually
a way that we can find a release valve when the pressure gets high, even as we leave it to people, the students, the parents, the support networks to look after each other? Would we consider, for example, a mental health day off when the student feels overwhelmed and just can't focus? And in that, you know, if so, how do we then avoid giving the impression that when the going gets tough, you can just stay at home? What do you think, Adrian?
I think that really makes sense. Even at companies right now, of course, we have mental wellness days, we have family care days. There's even some companies that allow you to be on medical leave without providing medical cert. Mm. As long as you don't feel well, you can tell the company you don't come in. But if you look at students, they don't really have those kind of benefits. There's no off in lieu. There's really nothing of that sort. They're expected to follow the calendar to a T.
No, they have school holidays.
Yeah, but still you're following the calendar to a T. Ma. Mm. So you're not supposed to fall sick outside of that, you know, way. You're not supposed to feel bad. You can only feel bad and down during school holiday, in essence, which doesn't work because it's so structured. It doesn't work that way. So I do think if there are some leeway when it comes to that, to cater to the individuality situation that each and every one of those individual students will be going through, to allow them that down day or downtime to release the valve, as you mentioned, I think that will be much appreciated.
So Shreling, you mentioned about the citizenship and character education module and having more counsellors in school announced by Minister Chan last week is part of that. But how do you see them both coming together? Would it be that then the serious cases get handed over to school counsellors? And how do you handle the impression that it's almost like detention?
That's why I mentioned early on that it's important to develop different help channels. We need to have teacher counselors and counselors in school because it's like your first aid station. You know, you need to have that present in schools. But at the same time, I recognize that there are young people who may not want to go to a teacher counselor for a variety of reasons, whether or not they feel that there's stigma and they may want to seek help outside. So for instance, I think many of the text messages or the calls that, you know, the SOS hotline as well as the National Care Hotline I talk about, they are anonymous. People are trying to seek help, trying to ask questions, but they don't want to reveal their identities. And there's nothing wrong with that. As long as that help channel performs the role it's supposed to perform, which is to be a help channel, then I think it's perfectly all right.
Really glad that you're talking about other avenues that kids can reach out to. Was this because you're considering also whether increasing counselor numbers could lead to teachers shouldering more responsibilities? Is that also a consideration?
I think we have to look at the total stock of teachers we have. And it's not just about what the MOE desires, you know, it's also what the teachers themselves want. You know, they have to be interested in the area. They have to undergo professional training. You want somebody who is empathetic, is somebody who is able to communicate at an empathetic level. Not everybody has the same skill sets. Yeah. The MOE has shared broadly about what the numbers are that we want to equip schools with, so they have a minimum number of teacher counselors. And if we have more of such professionals, obviously we would share them more with our schools so that they can help. But at the same time, we want to work with the rest of the community because really, I think people look for help in different ways. And it's not just students. There are also adults amongst us who face mental health issues, and we shouldn't forget about them. So when we work with partners and create these channels outside the formal school system, these help channels are available to all in the society.
Just one more question before I throw this over to Bettina. Are you also worried that that might be a transfer of student stress to teacher stress if it's overly institutionalized in schools?
The mental health of our teachers is absolutely important to us. We have check-ins with them, you know. We definitely don't want that to happen. And that's why I think it's important that we have the right people to do it. You know, people with the right skill sets and who feel that emotionally they are able to take this on. It's not an easy job. So I think we want to provide the training that's necessary for teacher counselors. But at the same time, you take a step back and look at it in totality. And where we feel that there is a need for us to also partner with community stakeholders and other social service agencies, then we'll readily do it.
I want to get into the nuts and bolts of this potential move with Adrian and Bettina. Adrian, what if parents disagree with what the school counselor says? For example, if the school counselor talks to your child about potentially dropping a subject or taking a subject at a less advanced level, what would your reaction be?
I definitely will seek second and third opinion, but I actually have experience of doing the opposite. The teacher wanted him to maintain, I wanted him to drop because I felt it may be better for him. But again, the school wins. So we just let him maintain on normal track. But I think I'll be getting the second and third opinion importantly, but also to gather feedback and understanding from him whether it is something that he wants to do, to stress upon that, knowing that it's very hard for him to make a firm decision right now, but of course trying to feed across all the possible options and consequences. Ultimately, it is his life to live out. So I think he has to have some say in this whole thing.
Bettina, how should counselors handle confidentiality? Do you see the circumstances that might override patient privilege to notify parents or teachers?
Yes, I tell my clients as well, if there's a risk to self or harm to self or others, or there's like crime, then we are obliged to breach confidentiality. That's professional ethics in terms of counseling. I recognize that a lot of clients go in, they want to not seek help, right? I mean, with the article that ran recently as well, that parental consent can be an obstacle. So this confidentiality, because they don't want parents to know, and therefore they go into anonymous helplines, or they also come to look for us because we do like these mental health screenings. It is needful to kind of protect the client and to kind of keep them safe. At the same time, depending on the context you work in and the organizations as well, sometimes it's kind of like, if I can sort of contract for my client to be safe, and it's sort of maybe low risk, then we try and put certain resources into place. But we always have this emergency contact, and they always know that if there is risk, we might have to kind of let the emergency contact or the parent know. Yeah, so I think it is safety measures in a sense. But unfortunately, it's a pros cons thing, law. Then it keeps a lot of young people from reaching out. And even sometimes parental consent with a lot of the young people I work with, they want to seek help, but the parents are saying, no, you don't need help. You know, no, you know, there's what depression, what anxiety. No, like, you're just being lazy. One of my clients told me that. She's like, yeah, my parents just think I don't want to do work. Then I use it as an excuse. You know, yeah. So this issue of parental consent, actually, I feel like is even more important to tackle because especially for those who are under 18, right? They don't want to see a school counselor. They can't seek intervention help outside because they require parental consent. But sometimes there is risk at home, right? There's actually risk to their lives. Like abusive parents, or that it's like just parents who feel like, you don't have this, they are in denial, or they feel, no, you don't need this. So I feel like that's where my heart goes out to this group of under 17, 16, where parental consent is required, but at the same time, until I get there, I cannot get help. And I have a client who says, you know, I can't wait till I'm like 18, then I can go and see a counselor. And that's sad, right? So you can do this anonymously, but if I want to be in therapy, I do want to see a counselor. I want to do longer, deeper term work. Then I'm a bit stuck.
Definitely, definitely. Sounds like parents would be the limiting factor.
Yeah, maybe you can think about this.
Well, no pressure, Shirley.
Yeah, no pressure, no pressure.
I know you've taken great pains to emphasize that it is challenging when schools are part of a larger microcosm of society and that mental health issues in school should not be seen solely through the lens of education. Having said that, I'm just going to go back to something that Minister Chan had also announced in his ministerial statement, where he said common last topics from this year's NO and A-levels would be removed and from year-end school exams too. What was the objective there? Because I sense that there's some level of very careful calibration. And do that actually suggest that the curriculum was overloaded in the first place?
No, I think it was more a recognition that these 2 years because of COVID-19 has been extraordinary. And because of COVID-19, there have been breaks in regular lesson time when there has been home-based learning. And home-based learning actually affects different groups of our students differently. Some of them have more conducive home environments, others may not. Disruptions to the lifestyle and the regular routine of learning may also impact some more than others. You know, so it's in consideration of these factors that the MOE decided to remove the common last topic so that we can, at least in the short term, cut down on the curriculum, give the students a bit of breathing space in this very difficult 2020-2021. I hope that they're not using the additional time to study even harder for the other topics. I don't know what's the outcome, to be honest. But we will do what we can at the MOE to try our very best to reduce stress, especially in these extraordinary times. That's our objective.
But a couple of years back, MOE had also said that they detect higher stress levels at higher performing schools. When you think about the OECD study that looked at kids who are afraid of failure, would MOE consider broad-based plans to reach all students when it comes to mental health, or would it be more targeted at specific schools?
The updated CCE curriculum that includes a focus on mental wellness is covered across all schools. And also other measures that we are taking to also improve social mixing. For instance, we introduced subject-based banding, where there's more opportunity for students from different classes to mix together on common topics, you know, such as CCE, PE, and so on and so forth. So we are trying to inject different permutations into our classes. And also Minister Chan in his ministerial statement also talked about how we were looking to bring back CCAs and all sorts of other activities in schools beyond academic work. Mm. This is our hypothesis, and we hope it's true, that when students have an opportunity to see that life is more than academics, that you are defined not by your academic grades. There is so much that life has to offer. If you enjoy kicking a football, then do so. If you want to come to school and hang around with your friends, we'll do our very best to keep the school environment safe from COVID, but we welcome you back. Please come, you know, and do all these happy things with your friends. We hope that by creating this kind of environment, that our students will not feel so bogged down and so stressed out by the exams. That's what we're trying to achieve. And we want to work really with parents.
But one feedback that I often get when I say the education system is changing and it's relieving more stress, broadening the definition of success, is people tell me, when you're in primary school, there's still the overhang of a high-stakes PSLE. Would MOE ever decide to abolish the PSLE or review doing so?
This is one of those discussions that we have so many views from both sides. We are taking baby steps in the sense that we have recently introduced achievement level bands so that that single mark, the previous T score, will not matter so much. And coupled with what I mentioned about subject-based banding, we're trying to just have more flexibility in the system. And I think even more important than that, right, is that we also have to work on the employer's side. Because at the end of the day, I think many practical parents in Singapore say, oh, you have to get a good grade so you can get a good job. I think we need to make sure that employers are not looking at PSLE scores.
So we can rule out standardized testing then?
We have to ask ourselves what standardized testing tries to achieve, which is that at the end of the day, we want to be able to cater resources to best help students in their studies. So if you're able to learn at a certain level, then the resources, the books that you use, the language, the difficulty level is at that level so that it's suitable for you. And if you need to take it at a different level, a lower level, then you also have curriculum that matches it. And actually that the exam sort of allows the MOE to better direct the resources. But what we're trying to get at, right, is that while we direct the resources so that every student is able to learn at the best level that he's comfortable with, we don't want that to prejudice the outcome for him. That's what we're trying to say. We don't want a situation that just because he's learning at that level, that he feels constricted in his options after he leaves school. And that can only happen if the rest of society, including employers, including societal expectations, that we don't box the student up and think that just because you handled learning at that level, that that's all they are good at. That's not true. I don't believe in that. I really don't believe in that at all.
Last question, just to make a last ditch effort to reducing stress from an education system, less so the academics, would you rule out starting later, starting school time later? Because some researchers have said that the circadian rhythms of young people are quite different.
I don't rule that out at all. I mean, the MOE approaches it from a practical standpoint, meaning what do parents feel about it? Is it something that works for the parents' schedule? Is it practical? Because if you start later, I would assume that you end later, assuming that you don't change curricular time. So if you end later, what does that mean? Our weather in Singapore is actually very hot and very humid in the afternoon. So whether or not it is a good learning environment in the afternoon, and if it's not, then how do we mitigate the issues with that? I think the other question we have in our minds is that we want to start later so that students can sleep more, right? Have longer sleep hours and hopefully good quality sleep, right? Then we have to ensure that it doesn't end up with a situation whereby because you start school later, that people feel that, oh, then I can sleep later. Actually, it defeats the purpose also. So I think we need to take all these factors into consideration, but I wouldn't rule that out. I wouldn't rule out starting school later. It comes down to what is practical, and the MOE will review it with the help of the research studies that is commissioning.
That was Minister of State for Education Sun Xueling, Councillor Bettina Yap, and parent Adrian Tan. This has been Heartland Matter with me, Lin Su Ling, Christina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. Signing off until next week.